toilet behind a carved screen, and a vanity and full-length mirror. Les steps in and wonders, who polished that mirror? Who filled the basin and cleaned the toilet? For that matter, who brought out these brass beds for spoiled creatures such as he? Who brought the pillows and carpets? Who said, they will probably like the coverlet with the little mirrors? On the nightstand, a dozen books in English, including a Peabody novel, and books by three god-awful American writers who, as at an exclusive party at which one is destined to run into the most banal acquaintance, dispelling not only the notion of the party's elegance but of one's own, seem to turn to Les and say, oh, they let you in too? And there among them, the latest from Finley Dwyer. Here in the Sahara, beside his big brass bed. Thanks, life. From the north, a camel bellowing to spite the dusk. From the south, Lewis screaming that there is a scorpion in his bed. From the west, the tinkle of flatware as the Bedouins set their dinner table. From the south again, Lewis shouting not to worry, it was just a paperclip. From the east, the British technology whiz come nightclub owner saying, guys, I don't feel so great. Who remains? Just four of them at dinner. Les, Lewis, Zora, and Mohammed. They finish the white wine by the fire and stare at one another across the flames. Mohammed quietly smokes a cigarette. Is it a cigarette? Zora stands and says she's going to bed so she can be beautiful for her birthday. Good night, all, and look at all the stars. Mohammed vanishes into the darkness, and it is just Lewis and Les who remain. Arthur, Lewis says in the crackling quiet, reclining on his pillows, I'm glad you came. Les sighs and breathes in the night. Above them, the Milky Way rises in a plume of smoke. He turns to his friend in the firelight. Happy anniversary, Lewis. Thank you. Clark and I are divorcing. Les sits straight up on his cushion. What? Lewis shrugs. We decided a few months ago. I have been waiting to tell you. Wait, wait, wait. What? What's going on? Shh. You'll wake Zora. And what's his name? He moves closer to Les, picking up his wine glass. Well, you know when I met Clark, back in New York at the art gallery, and we did that cross-country dating for a while, and finally I asked him to move to San Francisco. We were in the back room of the art bar, you remember, where you used to be able to buy Coke, on the couches, and Clark said, all right, I'll move to San Francisco. I'll live with you, but only for 10 years. After 10 years, I'll leave you. Les looks around, but of course there is no one to share his disbelief. You never told me that. Yes, he said, after 10 years, I'll leave you. And I said, oh, 10 years, that seems like plenty. That was all we ever talked about. He never worried about quitting his job or leaving his rent-controlled place. He never bugged me about whose pots we got to keep or whose we got to throw away. He just moved into my place and set up his life. Just like that. I didn't know any of this. I just thought you guys were together forever. Of course you did. I mean, I did too, honestly. Sorry, I'm just so surprised. Well, after 10 years, he said, let's take a trip to New York. So we went to New York. I'd forgotten all about the deal, really. Things were going so well, we were, you know, very, very happy together. We had a hotel in Soho above a Chinese lamp store, and he said, let's go to the art bar. So we took a taxi, and we went to the back room, and we had a drink, and he said, well, the 10 years are up, Lewis. This is Clark. Checking your expiration date? I know, he's hopeless. He'll drink any old carton of milk, but it's true. He said the 10 years are up. And I said, are you fucking serious? Are you leaving me, Clark? And he said, no. He wanted to stay. Thank God for that. For 10 more years. That's crazy, Lewis. It's like a timer. Like he's checking to see if it's done. You should have smacked him across the face. Or was he just messing with you? Were you guys high? No, no. Maybe you've never seen this side of him. He's so sloppy, I know. He leaves his underwear in the bathroom, right where he took it off. But, you know, Clark has another side that's very practical. He installed the solar panels. I think of Clark as so easygoing, and this is neurotic. I think he'd say it's practical, or forward-thinking. Anyway, we're in the art bar, and I said, well, okay, I love you too, let's get some champagne. And I didn't think about it again. Then, 10 years later, a few months ago, we were in New York, and he said, let's go to the art bar. You know, it's changed. It's not seedy or anything anymore. They moved the old mural of the Last Supper, and you can't even get Coke there. I guess, thank God, right? And we sat in the back. We ordered champagne, and he said, Lewis, I knew what was coming. I said, it's been 10 years, and he said, what do you think? We sat there for a long time drinking. And I said, honey, I think it's time. Lewis. Lewis. And he said, I think so too. And we hugged, there on the cushions in the back of the art bar. Were things not working out? You never told me. No, things have been really good. Well then why say it's time? Why give up? Because a few years ago, you remember I had a job down in Texas? Texas, Arthur. But it was good money, and Clark said, I support you, this is important. Let's drive down together, I've never seen Texas. And we got in the car and drove down. It was a good 4 days of driving, and we each got to make one rule about the road trip. Mine was that we could only sleep in places with a neon sign. His was that wherever we went, we had to eat the special. If they didn't have a special, we had to find another place. Oh my God, Arthur, the things I ate. One time the special was crab casserole in Texas. I know. You told me about it. That trip sounded great. It was maybe the best road trip we've ever taken. We just laughed and laughed the whole way, looking for neon signs. And then we got to Texas, and he kissed me goodbye and got on a plane back home, and there I was for 4 months. And I thought, well, that was nice. I don't understand. That sounds like you guys being happy. Yes. And I was happy in my little house in Texas going to work. And I thought, well, that was nice. That was a nice marriage. But you broke up with him. Something's wrong. Something failed. No. No, Arthur, no. It's the opposite. I'm saying it's a success. 20 years of joy and support and friendship, that's a success. 20 years of anything with another person is a success. If a band stays together 20 years, it's a miracle. If a comedy duo stays together 20 years, they're a triumph. Is this night a failure because it will end in an hour? Is the sun a failure because it's going to end in a billion years? No, it's the fucking sun. Why does a marriage not count? It isn't in us, it isn't in human beings, to be tied to one person forever. Siamese twins are a tragedy. 20 years and one last happy road trip, and I thought, well, that was nice. Let's end on success. You can't do this, Lewis. You're Lewis and Clark. Lewis and fucking Clark, Lewis. It's my only hope out there that gay men can last. Oh, Arthur, this is lasting. 20 years is lasting. And this has nothing to do with you. I just think it's a mistake. You're going to go out there on your own and find out there's nobody as good as Clark, and he's going to find the same thing. He's getting married in June. For fuck's sake. I'll tell you the truth, it was on that road trip we met a nice young man in Texas, a painter down in Marfa. We met him together, and they kept in touch, and now Clark's going to marry him. He's lovely. He's wonderful. You're going to the wedding, apparently. I'm reading a poem at the wedding. You are out of your mind. I'm sorry things didn't work out with Clark. I'm heartbroken, but I know it's not about me. I want you to be happy, but you're deluded. You can't go to his wedding. You can't think it's all fine, it's all great. You're just in a phase of denial. You're divorcing your partner of 20 years, and that's sad. It's okay to be sad, Lewis.
It's true, things can go on till you die. And people use the same old table, even though it's falling apart and it's been repaired and repaired, just because it was their grandmother's. That's how towns become ghost towns. It's how houses become junk stores. And I think it's how people get old.
Have you met someone?
Me? I think maybe I'll go it on my own. Maybe I'm better that way. Maybe I was always better that way, and it was just that when I was young, I was so scared, and now I'm not scared. I still have Clark. I can still always call Clark and ask his advice.
Even after everything?
Yes, Arthur. They talk a bit longer, and the sky shifts above them until it is quite late. Arthur, Lewis says at one point, did you hear that Freddie locked himself in the bathroom the night before the wedding? But Les is not listening. He is thinking about how he used to visit Lewis and Clark over the years, about the dinner parties and Halloweens, and times he slept on their couch, too tipsy to get home. Good night, Arthur. Lewis gives his old friend a salute and heads into the darkness, so Les is left alone by the dying fire. A brightness catches his eye. Muhammad's cigarette as he moves from tent to tent, buttoning the flaps like he is tucking in sleeping children for the night. From the furthermost tent, the tech whiz moans from his bed. From somewhere, a camel complains, followed by a young man's voice soothing it. Do they sleep beside the creatures? Do they sleep under this most excellent canopy, this majestical roof, this amazing mirrored coverlet, the stars? Look you, there are enough stars for everyone tonight, and among them shine the satellites, those counterfeit coins. He reaches for, but does not catch, a falling star. Les, at last, goes to bed. But he cannot stop thinking of what Lewis has told him. Not the story about the 10 years, but the idea of being alone. He realizes that, even after Robert, he never truly let himself be alone. Even here on this trip, first Bastian, then Javier. Why this endless need for a man as a mirror? To see the Arthur Les reflected there? He is grieving, for sure, the loss of his lover, his career, his novel, his youth. So why not cover the mirrors, rend the fabric over his heart, and just let himself mourn? Perhaps he should try alone. He chuckles to himself in the moments before sleep. Alone. Impossible to imagine. That life seems as terrifying, as un-Lessian, as that of a castaway on a desert island. The sandstorm does not start until dawn. As Les lies sleepless in bed, his novel appears in his mind. Swift. What a title. What a mess. Swift. Where is his editor when he needs her? His editrix, as he used to call her, Leona Flowers. Traded years ago in the card game of publishing to some other house, but Les recalls how she took his first novels, shaggy with magniloquent prose, and made them into books. So clever, so artful, so good at persuading him of what to cut. This paragraph is so beautiful, so special, she might say, pressing her French manicured hands to her chest, that I'm keeping it all to myself. Where is Leona now? High in some tower with some new favorite author, trying her same old lines. I think the chapter's absence will echo throughout the novel. What would she tell him? More likable. Make Swift more likable. That's what everyone's saying. Nobody cares what this character suffers. But how do you do it? It's like making oneself more likable. And at 50, Les muses drowsily, you're as likable as you're going to get. The sandstorm. So many months of planning, so much travel, so much expense, and here they are. Trapped inside as the wind whips their tents like a man with a mule. They are gathered, the three of them, Zora, Lewis, Les, in the large dining tent, hot as a camel ride and just as smelly, with its heavy horsehair sand door that has not been washed, and three visitors who have not been either. Only Muhammad seems fresh and cheerful, though he tells Les he was awakened at dawn by the sandstorm and had to run for shelter, for he has indeed slept out of doors. "Well," Lewis announcing over coffee and honeyed flatbreads, "we are being given an opportunity for a different experience than the one we were expecting." Zora greets this with a raised butter knife. Tomorrow is her birthday. But they must submit to the sand. They spend the rest of the day drinking beer and playing cards, and Zora fleeces them both. "I'll get my revenge," Lewis threatens, and they go to bed to find in the morning that, like a bad house guest, the storm has no intention of leaving, and moreover, that Lewis has proved prophetic. He has been afflicted as well. He lies on his mirrored bed, sweating, moaning, "Kill me, kill me," as the wind shakes his tent. Muhammad appears, swathed in indigo and violet, full of regret.
"The sandstorm is only in these dunes. We drive out of the desert. It is gone."
He suggests they pile Lewis and Josh into the jeeps and head back to Mhamid, where at least there is a hotel and a bar with a television, where the others, the war reporters, the violinist, the male model, are waiting. Zora, only her eyes showing in the folds of her bright green shesh, blinks silently. "No," she says finally, and turns to Les, ripping off her veil. "No, it's my birthday, goddammit! Dump the others in Mhamid. But we are going somewhere, Arthur. Muhammad, where can you drive us that we wouldn't believe?" Would you believe Morocco has a Swiss ski town? For that is where Muhammad has taken them, driving them out of the sandstorm and through deep canyons where hotels are carved into the rock and Germans, ignoring the hotels, camp beside the river in beat-up Westphalias. Past villages that, as in a folktale, seem inhabited only by sheep. Past waterfalls and weirs, madrasas and mosques, kasbahs and kasars, and one small town, a lunch stop, where the next-door woodcarver is visited by a woman all in teal who borrows his shavings to sprinkle them on her doorstep where it seems her cat has peed, and where boys are gathered in what at first seems to be an outdoor school, and later, when the cheering starts, turns out to be a televised football match. Through limestone plateaus, up the spiling ziggurat roads of the Middle Atlas, until the vegetation changes from fronds to needles, where, passing through a chilly pine forest, Muhammad says, "Look out for beasts." And at first there is nothing, until Zora screams and points to where sits on a wooden platform, and turning as if interrupted at tea or déjeuner sur l'herbe, a troop of poker-faced Barbary macaques, or as she puts it, monkeys! Their own troop is now far away in Mhamid, and Les and Zora are alone, seated in the dark-scented bar of the Alpine Resort, in leather club chairs with glasses of local marc, below a crystal chandelier and before a crystal panorama. They have eaten pigeon pie. Muhammad sits at the bar drinking an energy drink. Gone is his desert costume. He has changed back into a polo shirt and jeans. It is Zora's birthday. It will be Les's at midnight in about 2 hours' time. Satisfaction has arrived indeed on a later camel. "And all this," Zora is saying, brushing her hair out of her face. "All this travel, Arthur. Just to miss your boyfriend's wedding?"
"Not a boyfriend, and more to avoid the confusion," Les answers, feeling himself blushing.
They are the only guests in the bar. The bartenders, two men in striped vaudeville vests, seem to be deciding on a cigarette break with the frantic, whispered patter of a comedy routine. He has been telling Zora about his trip, and somehow the champagne has let his tongue get away from him. Zora wears a gold pantsuit and diamond earrings. They have checked into the hotel, showered and changed, and she smells of perfume. Surely when she packed for her birthday trip, she picked these things for someone other than Les. But he is who she has. He wears, of course, his blue suit.
"You know what?"
Zora says, holding out the glass and staring at it.
"This hooch reminds me of my grandmother in Georgia. The Republic, not the state. She used to make something just like this."
"It just seemed better," Les continues, still on Freddy, "to get away and bring this novel back to life." Zora sips her mark and stares at the view, such as it is at this hour.
"Mine left me too," she says.
Les sits quietly for a moment, then says suddenly, Oh no, he didn't leave me.
Janet was supposed to be here."
Zora closes her eyes.
"Arthur, you're here because there was an empty space and Lewis said he had a friend. That's why you're here. It's lovely to have you. I mean, you're all that's left. Everybody else is so fucking weak. What happened to everybody? I'm glad you're here. But I'll be honest with you. I'd rather have her."
For some reason, it never occurred to Les that she was a lesbian. Perhaps he is a bad gay after all.
"What happened?" he asks.
"What else?"
Zora says, sipping from the little glass.
"She fell in love. She lost her mind."
Les murmurs his sympathy, but Zora is lost in herself. At the bar, the taller man seems to have won and heads out in long strides to the balcony. The short man, bald on top except for a single oasis, stares after his friend with unconcealed longing. Outside, a view perhaps of Gestad or St. Moritz, the dark rolling forests of sleeping macaques, the Romanesque steeple of a skating rink, the cold black sky.
"She told me she met the love of her life," Zora says at last, still staring out the window. "You read poems about it. You hear stories about it. You hear Sicilians talk about being struck by lightning. We know there's no love of your life. Love isn't terrifying like that. It's walking the fucking dog so the other can sleep in. It's doing taxes. It's cleaning the bathroom without hard feelings. It's having an ally in life. It's not fire. It's not lightning. It's what she always had with me. Isn't it? But what if she's right, Arthur? What if the Sicilians are right? That it's this earth-shattering thing she felt. Something I've never felt. Have you?"
Les begins to breathe unevenly. She turns to him.
"What if one day you meet someone, Arthur, and it feels like it could never be anyone else? Not because other people are less attractive, or drink too much, or have issues in bed, or have to alphabetize every fucking book, or organize the dishwasher in some way you just can't live with. It's because they aren't this person, this woman Janet met. Maybe you can go through your whole life and never meet them, and think love is all these other things, but if you do meet them, God help you. Because then, kablam, you're screwed, the way Janet is. She ruined our life for it. But what if that's real?"
She is gripping the chair now.
"Zora, I'm so sorry."
"Is it like that with this Freddy?"
I...
"The brain is so wrong all the time," she says, turning to the dark landscape again. "Wrong about what time it is, and who people are, and where home is. Wrong, wrong, wrong. The lying brain."
This insanity, the insanity of her lover, has her bewildered and hurt and incandescent. And yet what she has said, the lying brain, this is familiar. This has happened to him. Not exactly like this, not utter terrifying madness, but he knows his brain has told him things he has traveled around the world to forget. That the mind cannot be trusted is a certainty.
"What is love, Arthur? What is it?" she asks him. "Is it the good, dear thing I had with Janet for 8 years? Is it the good, dear thing? Or is it the lightning bolt? The destructive madness that hit my girl?"
It doesn't sound happy, is all he can say. She shakes her head.
Arthur, happiness is bullshit. That is the wisdom I give you from my 22 hours of being 50. That is the wisdom from my love life.
You'll understand at midnight. It is clear she is drunk. Outside, the shivering bartender smokes like he means it. She sniffs the glass of Mark and says,
My Georgian grandmother used to make booze just like this.
It keeps ringing in his ears. Is it the good, dear thing? Is it the good, dear thing?
Yes.
She smiles at the memory and sniffs the glass.
It smells just like my grandmother's cha-cha.
The cha-cha proves too much for the birthday girl, and by 11:30, he and Mohammed are leading her up to her room as she smiles and thanks them. He puts her, happily drunk, to bed. She is speaking French to Mohammed, who comforts her in the same language, and then again in English. As Les tucks her in, she says,
Well, that was ridiculous, Arthur. I'm sorry.
As he closes her door, he realizes that he will spend his 50th birthday alone. He turns. Not alone. Mohammed, how many languages do you speak?
7,
he says brightly, striding to the elevator.
I learn from school. They make fun of my Arabic when I come to the city. It is old-fashioned. I learned in Berber school, so I work more hard. And from tourists. Sorry. Still learning English. And you, Arthur?
7. My God. The elevator is completely mirrored, and as the doors close, Les is confronted by a vision. Infinite Mohammeds in red polo shirts beside infinite versions of his father at 50, which is to say, himself.
I speak English and German.
Ich auch, says Mohammed.
The following is translated from the German.
I lived for 2 years in Berlin. Such boring music. I have been coming from there. Is excellent, your German. And yours is good. Here we are. You first, Arthur. Are you ready for your birthday? I am fear of the age. Don't be frightened. 50 is nothing. You're a handsome man, and healthy, and rich.
He wants to say he is not rich, but stops himself. How many year have you?
I'm 53. You see? It's nothing. Nothing at all. Let's get you a glass of champagne. I am fear of the old. I am fear of the lonely. You have nothing to fear.
He turns to a woman who has taken over the station behind the bar, easily his height, with her hair in a ponytail, and speaks to her in the Moroccan dialect of Arabic. Perhaps he is asking for champagne for the American who has just turned 50. The bartender beams at Les, raises her eyebrows, and says something. Mohammed laughs. Les just stands with his idiot's grin.
Happy birthday, sir,
she says in English, pouring out a glass of French champagne.
This is my treat.
Les offers to buy Mohammed a drink, but the man will indulge only in energy drinks. Not because of Islam, he explains. He is agnostic.
Because alcohol makes me crazy. Crazy. But I smoke hashish. Would you like?
No, not tonight. It makes me crazy. Mohammed, are you really a tour guide?
I must to make a living, Mohammed says, suddenly shy in his English. But in truth, I am writer, like you.
How does Les get the world so wrong? Over and over again. Where is the exit from moments like this? Where is the donkey door out?
Mohammed, I am honored to be with you tonight. I am very great fan of Calypso. Of course, I read not the English, but the French. I am honored to be with you. And happy birthday, Arthur Les.
Probably now Tom and Freddy are packing their bags. They are many hours ahead, after all, and in Tahiti it is midday. Surely the sun is already hammering the beach like a tinsmith, The grooms are folding their linen shirts, their linen pants and jackets, or surely Freddy is folding them. He recalls Freddy was always the packer, while Les lounged on the hotel sofa. "You're too fast and sloppy," Freddy said that last morning in Paris, "and everything comes out wrinkled. See? Watch this." He spread out the jackets and shirts on the bed like they were clothes for a great paper doll, placed the pants and sweaters on top, and folded the whole thing up in a bundle. Hands on his hips, he smiled in triumph. "By the way, everyone is completely naked in this scene." "And now what?" Les asked. Freddy shrugged. "Now we just put it in the luggage." But of course this bolus was too large for the luggage to swallow, no matter how Freddy coaxed it, and after many tries of sitting and pressing, he eventually remade it into two packages, which he fit neatly into two bags. Victorious, he looked smugly at Les. Framed in the window with that lean silhouette from his early 40s, the spring Paris rain dotting the window behind him, Freddy's former lover nodded and asked,
"Mr. Pelu, you've packed everything. Now what are we going to wear?"
Freddy attacked him in a fury, and for the next half an hour they wore nothing at all. Yes, surely Mr. Pelu is folding. Surely this is why he never calls to wish Les a happy birthday. And now Les stands on the balcony of the Swiss Hotel looking out over the frozen town. The railing is carved absurdly with cuckoos, each with a sharp, protruding beak. In his glass, the last coin of champagne. Now he is off to India, to work on his novel, on what was supposed to be a mere final glaze, and now appears to be breaking the whole novel to shards and starting again. To work on the tedious, self-centered, pitiable, laughable character, Swift. The one nobody feels bad for. Now he is 50. We all recognize grief in moments that should be celebrations. It is the salt in the pudding. Didn't Roman generals hire slaves to march beside them in a triumphant parade and remind them that they too would die? Even your narrator, one morning after what should have been a happy occasion, was found shivering at the end of the bed. Spouse, I really wish you weren't crying right now. Don't little children, awakened one morning and told, "Now you're 5, don't they wail at the universe's descent into chaos?" The sun slowly dying, the spiral arms spreading, the molecules drifting apart second by second toward our inevitable heat death. Shouldn't we all wail to the stars? But some people do take it a little too hard. It's just a birthday, after all. There is an old Arabic story about a man who hears death is coming for him, so he sneaks away to Samarra. And when he gets there, he finds death in the market, and death says, "You know, I just felt like going on vacation to Samarra. I was going to skip you today, but how lucky you showed up to find me." And the man is taken, after all. Arthur Les has traveled halfway around the world in a cat's cradle of junkets, changing flights and fleeing from a sandstorm into the Atlas Mountains like someone erasing his trail or outfoxing a hunter, and yet time has been waiting here all along. In a snowy alpine resort. With cuckoos. Of course, time would turn out to be Swiss. He tosses back the champagne. He thinks, hard to feel bad for a middle-aged white man. Indeed, even Les can't feel bad for Swift anymore. Like a wintertime swimmer too numb to feel cold, Arthur Les is too sad to feel pity. For Robert, yes, breathing through an oxygen tube up in Sonoma. For Marion, nursing a broken hip that might ground her forever. For Javier in his marriage, and even for Bastian's tragic sports teams. For Zora and Janet. For his fellow writer Mohammed. Around the world, his pity flies, its wingspan as wide as an albatross's. But he can no more feel sorry for Swift, now become a gorgon of Caucasian male ego, snake-headed, pacing through his novel and turning each sentence to stone, than Arthur Les can feel sorry for himself. He hears the balcony door open beside him, and sees the short waiter return from his smoke break. The man points to a cuckoo on the railing and speaks to him in perfectly understandable French, if only he understood French. Laughable. Arthur Less. He suddenly stands very still, as one does when about to swat a fly. Don't let it go. Distractions are pulling at his mind. Robert. Freddy, 50. Tahiti. Flowers. The waiter, gesturing at Les's coat sleeve. But he will not look at them. Don't let it escape. Laughable. His mind is converging on one point of light. What if it isn't a poignant, wistful novel at all? What if it isn't the story of a sad middle-aged man on a tour of his hometown, remembering the past and fearing the future? A peripateticism of humiliation and regret? The erosion of a single male soul? What if it isn't even sad? For a moment, his entire novel reveals itself to him like those shimmering castles that appear to men crawling through deserts. It vanishes. The balcony door slams shut. The sleeve of the blue suit remains snagged on a cuckoo's beak. A tear lies seconds in the future. But Les does not notice. He is clinging to the one thought that remains. Ah, 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 comes the Lessian laugh. His Swift isn't a hero. He's a fool. Well, he whispers to the night air, happy birthday, Arthur Less. Just for the record, happiness is not bullshit.
Less Indian. For a 7-year-old boy, the boredom of sitting in an airport lounge is rivaled only by lying convalescent in bed. This particular boy, 1/6,000th of whose life has already been squandered in this airport, has gone through every pocket of his mother's purse and found nothing of interest but a keychain made of plastic crystals. He is considering the waste paper basket, its swinging lid holds possibilities, when he notices, through the lounge's window, the American. The boy has not seen one all day. He watches the American with the same detached, merciless fascination with which he has watched the robotic scorpions that circle the airport bathroom drain. Epically tall, brutally blonde, the American stands in his beige, wilted linen shirt and pants, smiling at the escalator regulations sign. The sign, so scrupulously unabridged that it includes advice on pet safety, is longer than the escalator itself. This seems to amuse the American. The boy watches as the man pats every pocket on his person, then nods in satisfaction. He looks up at a closed-circuit television to follow the fleeting romances between flights and gates, then heads down to join a line. Though everyone has already passed through at least 3 checkpoints, a man at the head of the line has everyone take out their passport and boarding pass once more. This superfluous verification also seems to amuse the American. But it is warranted. At least 3 people are about to board the wrong flight. The American is one of them. Who knows what adventures awaited him in Hyderabad? We will never know, for he is shown to another gate. Thiruvananthapuram. He becomes absorbed in a notebook. Soon enough, a worker is rushing over to tap the American on the shoulder, and the foreigner pops up to rush for the flight that he is yet again about to miss. They disappear together down a foreshortened corridor. The boy, already attuned to comedy at his young age, presses his nose against the glass and awaits the inevitable. A moment later, the American springs back to grab the forgotten satchel and vanishes again, this time surely for good. The boy tilts his head as boredom begins to flood. His mother asks if he needs to wee, and he says yes, but only so he can see the scorpions again.
Here are the black ants. They are your neighbors. Nearby there is Elizabeth, the yellow rat snake, who is the parson's special friend. Although he says he is happy to kill her if you want him to. But then there will be rats. Do not be afraid of the mongoose. Do not encourage the stray dogs. They are not our pets. Do not open the windows, because small bats will want to visit you, and possibly monkeys. and if you walk at night, stomp on the ground to scare off other animals.
Les asks what other animals could there possibly be. Rupali answers quite solemnly,
Let us never know.
A writer's retreat on a hill above the Arabian Sea on Carlos's suggestion half a year ago. It has been a long journey, but Les has arrived at last. The dreaded birthday, the dreaded wedding, are both behind him now. Ahead is the novel, and with an idea of how to go forward, he will finally have a chance to conquer it. Gone are the cares of Europe and Morocco. Present still are the cares of the Delhi airport, the Chennai airport, and those of Thiruvananthapuram. In Thiruvananthapuram, he was met by a seemingly delighted woman, the manager, Rupali, who graciously led him across a steaming parking lot to a white Tata driven, he was later to learn, by a relative. This driver was proud to show Les a TV set in the dashboard of his car. Les was alarmed. And off they went. Rupali, a slim and elegant woman with a neat black braid and the refined profile of a Caesar on a coin, tried to engage him with conversation about politics, literature, and art, but Les was too enchanted by the ride itself. It was nothing like he expected. The sun flirting with him among the trees and houses. The driver speeding along a crumbling road alongside which trash was piled as if washed there. And what first looked like a beach beside a river turned out to be an accretion of a million plastic bags, as a coral reef is an accretion of a million tiny animals. The endless series of shops, as if made from one continuous concrete barrier, painted at intervals with different signs advertising chickens and medicine, coffins and telephones, pet fish and cigarettes, hot tea and homely food. Communism, mattresses, handicrafts, Chinese food, haircuts and dumbbells and gold by the ounce. The low flat temples appearing at regular intervals like the colorful, elaborately frosted but basically inedible sheet cakes displayed at Les's childhood bakery. The women sitting roadside with baskets of shimmering silver fish, terrifying manta rays and squid with their cartoon eyes. The countless men standing at tea shops, variety stores, pharmacies, watching Les as he goes by. The driver dodging bicycles, motorcycles, lorries, but few cars, moving frenetically in and out of traffic, bringing Les back to the time at Disney World when his mother led him and his sister to a whimsical ride based on The Wind in the Willows, a ride that turned out to be a knuckle-whitening rattletrap wellspring of trauma. Nothing, nothing here is what he expected. Rupali leads him down a path of red dirt. The ends of her pink scarf float behind her.
Here, she says, gesturing to a purple flower, is the 10 o'clock. It opens at 10 and closes at 5.
Like the British Museum.
There is also a 4 o'clock, Rupali counters, and the drowsy tree, which opens at sunrise and closes at sunset. The plants here are more punctual than the people. You will see. And this plant is more alive.
She touches her chapel to a small fern which instantly shrinks from her touch, folding in its leaves. Les is horrified. They arrive at a spot where the coconut trees part.
Here is a possibly inspiring view.
It certainly is. A cliff overhanging a mangrove forest, at the edge of which the Arabian Sea flogs the coast as mercilessly as an inquisitor, foaming up in white crests against the pale and impenitent sand. Beside him, at the cliffside, the coconut trees frame a view of birds and insects, as filled with living creatures as the waters of a coral shelf. Eagles, red and white-headed, floating in pairs high above, and covens of irritated crows massing on the treetops. And nearby, yellow-black biplane dragonflies buzzing around in a dogfight at the entrance of a little house.
And here is your little house.
The cottage, like the other buildings, is made in the South Indian style. All brick, with a tile roof over an open wooden lattice that lets in the air. But the cottage is pentagonal and, curiously,
Rather than leave the space whole, the architects have divided it like a nautilus shell into smaller and smaller rooms until it reaches the end of its ingenuity at a tiny desk and an inlaid portrait of the Last Supper. Les stares at this curiously for a moment. The paper trail has been lost, so it is hard to know whether in his haste Les missed a crucial piece of information, or whether it was delicately withheld by Carlos Pelu, but it turns out that rather than a typical artist residency at which to finish a novel, a place full of art, providing 3 vegetarian meals a day, a yoga mat, and Ayurvedic tea, Arthur Les has booked himself into a Christian retreat center. He has nothing personal against Christ. Though raised Unitarian, with its glaring omission of Jesus and a hymnal so unorthodox that it was years before Les understood accentuate the positive was not in the Book of Common Prayer, Les is technically Christian. There is really no other word for someone who celebrates Christmas and Easter, even if only as craft projects. And yet he is somehow deflated. To travel to the other side of the world only to be offered a brand he could so easily buy at home.
"Services are Sunday morning, of course," Rupali tells him,
gesturing to a small gray church that, in the midst of these lively outbuildings, sits as humorless as a recess monitor. So, here he will rewrite his novel. With God's happiness.
"And a note arrived for you."
An envelope on the miniature desk, below the image of Judas. Les opens it and reads,
"Arthur, contact me once you arrive. I'll be at the resort. I hope you arrived in one piece."
It is on business stationery signed, "Your friend, Carlos." After Rupali leaves, Les takes out his famous rubber bands.
"Have you noticed?"
Rupali asks him a few mornings later at breakfast in the low brick main building, a kind of fortress above the ocean.
"How the morning sounds so much sweeter than the evening."
She is talking about the birds, awakening in harmony and bedding down in discord. But Les can think only of that racket particular to India, the spiritual battle of the bands.
"It seems to begin before dawn with the Muslims, when a mosque at the edge of the mangrove forest softly announces in a lullaby voice the morning call to prayer.
Not to be outdone, the local Christians soon crank up pop-sounding hymns that last anywhere from 1 to 3 hours. This is followed by a cheerful, though over-amplified, kazoo-like refrain from the Hindu temple that reminds Les of the ice cream truck from his childhood. Then comes a later call to prayer. Then the Christians decide to ring some bronze bells, and so on. There are sermons and live singers and thunderous drum performances. In this way, the faiths alternate throughout the day as at a music festival, growing louder and louder until, during the outright cacophony of sunset, the Muslims, who began the whole thing, declare victory by projecting not only the evening call to prayer, but the prayer itself in its entirety. After that, the jungle falls to silence. Perhaps this is the Buddhist's sole contribution. Every morning it starts again.
"You must let me know," Rupali says, "what we can do to help with your writing. You are our first writer."
"I could use a freestanding desk," Les suggests, hoping to liberate himself from writing in the heart of his Nautilus. "And a tailor. I tore my suit in Morocco, and I seem to have lost my sewing needle."
"We will take care of these. The pastor will know a good tailor."
The pastor. And peace and quiet. I need that above all.
"Of course, of course, of course," she insists, shaking her head, and her gold earrings sway from side to side.
A writer's retreat on a hill above the Arabian Sea. Here he will kill his old novel, tear out the flesh that he wants, stitch it to all new material, electrocute it with inspiration, and make it rise from the slab and stumble toward Cormorant Publishing. Here, in this little room, there is so much to inspire him. The gray-green river flows below him among the coconuts and mangroves. On the other bank, Les can make out a black bull in the sun, sleek and glorious,
with two white markings like socks on its hind legs, more like a person transformed into a bull than an actual bull. Nearby, white smoke rises from a jungle blaze. So much. He is remembering, falsely, something Robert once told him.
Boredom is the only real tragedy for a writer. Everything else is material.
Robert never said anything of the sort. Boredom is essential for writers. It is the only time they get to write. Looking around for inspiration, Les's eyes fall upon his torn blue suit hanging in the closet, and he decides this is the priority. The novel is set aside. The pastor turns out to be a tanned and miniature Groucho Marx in a cassock that buttons at one shoulder like a fast food uniform, friendly and eager, as Rupali mentioned, to kill his friend the snake. He also possesses a genius for invention adults only have in children's books. A house with rain collectors and bamboo pipes bringing water to a common cistern, and a way to turn food waste into cooking gas with a hose that leads directly into his stove. And there is his 3-year-old daughter, who runs around wearing nothing but a rhinestone necklace. Who wouldn't if they could? She is able to count in English methodically as a cart climbing uphill, up to the number 14, and then the wheels come off.
21,
she screams in delight.
18, 43, 11, twine.
Mr. Arthur, you are a writer,
the pastor says to him as they stand outside his house.
I want you to ask, why? Everything that seems strange here or foolish, ask. Why? For instance, motorcycle helmets.
Motorcycle helmets. Les repeats.
You have noticed everybody wears them. It is the law. But nobody fastens the strap, yes?
I haven't been out much.
They won't fasten it, and what's the point? Why wear it if it will fly off? Foolish, yes? It looks typically Indian, typically absurd. But ask, why?
Les can't resist. Why?
Because there is a reason. It's not foolishness. It's because a man can't make a phone call if it's fastened during his 2-3 hour trip home. And you're thinking, why talk while driving? Why not just stop on this side of the road? Foolish, yes? Mr. Les, look at the road. Look.
Les sees a line of women, all in saris of bright colored cloth edged in gold thread, some carrying purses, some metal bins on their heads, making their way through the rocks and weeds beside the crumbled asphalt. The pastor spreads his arms wide.
There is no side of the road.
From the pastor, he learns the way to the tailor, whom he finds asleep beside his treadle, smelling distinctly of signature whiskey. Les deliberates whether to wake him, but then a stray dog trots by, black and white, and barks at them both, and the man awakens of his own accord. Automatically, the tailor picks up a stone and throws it at the dog, who vanishes.
Why?
Then he notices Les. His smile tilts up toward our protagonist. He explains his unshaven chin by pointing to Les's own.
Money comes in. We will shave.
Les says, yes, possibly, and shows him the suit. The man waves his hand at the ease of the repair.
Come back this time tomorrow,
he says, and he and the famous suit disappear into the shop. Les feels the brief pang of separation, then takes a deep breath and aims himself downhill toward town. He means to meander for 15 minutes or so and then get straight back to work. When he passes the shop again 2 hours later, he has sweated through his shirt and his face is aglow. His hair is clipped quite short, and his beard is gone. The tailor grins, pointing to his own chin. He has indeed himself purchased a shave. Les nods and nods and trudges up the hill. He is stopped multiple times by neighbors trying out their English, offering him tea or a visit to their home or a ride to church. Once back in his room, recalling there is no shower, he wearily fills the red plastic bucket, disrobes, and drenches himself in cold water. He dries himself, dresses, and sits down to write.
Hello?
comes a call from outside his cottage.
I am here to measure you for your desk.
To what? Les yells.
To measure you for your desk.
When he emerges in damp linen, there is indeed a portly bald man with a teenager's faint mustache, smiling and holding out a length of cloth tape.